This is an ABC Radio National podcast, and we have many more to choose from, which you can hear details about after this program. But right now, we hope you enjoy this podcast.
Good morning. Time for The Book Show with me, Ramona Koval. On ABC Radio National, today, Kate Grenville speaking about her new novel, Lieutenant, returning to the landscape of the Secret River. The book is inspired by the notebooks of a young man who came to New South Wales on the First Fleet with an interest in astronomy and in languages. Kate has imagined the friendship he forms with an Aboriginal girl, which changes the trajectory of his days. And in first person, we're continuing reading extracts from The Stories Our Parents Found Too Painful to Tell by Raphael Reisner. In Kate Grenville's new novel, The Lieutenant, soldier and astronomer Daniel Rook arrives on the First Fleet to New South Wales and begins his observations. He's a loner of sorts, taken up with his own interests, and manages to hive off to a makeshift observatory where he can be alone with his thoughts and his measurements. But his interest in languages takes over when he makes contact with a young girl named Tagaran, and between them they try and make sense of the place they find themselves, between cultures and time. This book follows her most successful novel, The Secret River, which won the 2006 Commonwealth Writers Prize, also set in the early years of the settlement of New South Wales. That one on the life and times of William Thornhill, who was sentenced in 1806 to be transported to New South Wales for the term of his natural life. And it was a book that looked at the idea of him taking up land on the Hawkesbury River, and this phrase, taking up land, that Kate Grenville examined, because it's a phrase that doesn't instantly invoke the risk and the bloodshed that actually happened. It was a look at the encounters between black and white people, a very different one to the one that's described in The Lieutenant. That book sparked a debate in Australian literary circles on the role of fiction as history. And so by writing The Lieutenant, Kate Grenville must have honed her ideas on this topic as well as on many others. She's in our Sydney studio. Welcome to The Book Show, Kate.
Thank you very much, Ramona.
Now, this book had its genesis, I understand, when you came across an extract from a notebook a few years ago. Tell me about what sparked you.
Yes, I was researching The Secret River, and I glanced at a book put together by Tim Flannery, which was an extract from all the diaries that the many First Fleet people had kept. One of them was a few pages from the language notebooks of William Dawes. Dawes learnt the language, as you said in your introduction, but the way he wrote it down was not just word lists. He recorded entire conversations, short exchanges, between him and particularly the young girl Patchigarang. And what Tim Flannery did in his book was to quote some of these astonishing conversations, between the lines of which it's obvious that a friendship quite extraordinary and remarkable was developing. And that the idea of a young soldier in 1788 having that kind of relationship absolutely electrified me. I knew also that he had been forced later into a terrible moral decision when he was sent out on a punitive expedition which was ordered to kill Aboriginal men who may well have been related to Patchigarang. So I had, on the one hand, character and a relationship, on the other hand, this kind of plot thing of the moral dilemma that he was thrust into.
And then you knew what happened to him in the end, because you researched his life, is that right?
That's right. I went away and did such research as I could in his life, and I discovered that after he'd left New South Wales under a bit of a cloud, he devoted the rest of his life to the abolition movement, to abolish slavery, and in fact really gave the rest of his life to slaves and former slaves.
So you've got a trajectory of a life, and you've got some questions.
A lot of questions. I love to write a book out of questions. In fact, I think it's the only way my writing can operate. If there's something I don't understand, I mean, I found that relationship across such unbelievable gulfs, not just of language, but culture and background and everything, between the young soldier and the young Aboriginal girl, incredibly puzzling. absolutely charming and appealing, but also quite puzzling. I also found his moral choice at the end very suggestive. It brought up all sorts of questions about altruism, morality. On what basis should we conduct ourselves? You know, is self-interest the only way to make decisions?
All right. Well, let's begin by reading where you begin. Can you read that first reading from the beginning of this book?
Yes. Daniel Rook was quiet, moody, a man of few words. He had no memories other than of being an outsider. At the Dame School in Portsmouth, they thought him stupid. His first day there was, by coincidence, his fifth birthday, the 3rd of March, 1767. He took his place behind the desk with his mother's breakfast oatmeal cosy in his stomach and his new jacket on, happy to be joining the world beyond his home. Mrs. Bartholomew showed him a badly executed engraving with the word cat underneath. His mother had taught him his letters, and he had been reading for a year, so he could not work out what Mrs. Bartholomew wanted. He sat at his desk, mouth open. That was the first time he was paddled with Mrs. Bartholomew's old hairbrush, for failing to respond to a question so simple he had not thought to answer it. He could not become interested in the multiplication tables. While the others chanted through them, impatient for the morning break, he was looking under the desk at the notebook in which he was collecting his special numbers, the ones that could not be divided by any number but themselves and one. Like him, they were solitaries. When Mrs. Bartholomew pounced on him one day and seized the notebook, he was afraid she would throw it in the fire and smack him with the hairbrush again. But she looked at it for a long time and then put it away in her penny pocket. He wanted to ask for it back. Not for the numbers, they were in his head, but for the notebook, too precious to lose. Then Dr. Adair from the Academy came to the house in Church Street. Rook could not guess who Dr. Adair was or what he was doing in their parlour. He only knew that he had been washed and combed for a visitor, that his infant sisters had been sent next door to the neighbour woman, and that his mother and father were sitting on the uncomfortable chairs in the corner with rigid faces. Dr. Adair leaned forward. Did Master Rook know of numbers that could be divided by nothing but themselves and one? Rook forgot to be in awe. He ran up to his attic room and came back with the grid he had drawn, 10 by 10, the first 100 numbers, with those special ones done in red ink, 2, 3, 5, and on to 97. He pointed. There was a kind of pattern, do you see, here and here? But 100 numbers was not enough. He needed a bigger sheet of paper so he could make a square 20 or even 30 aside, and then he could find the true pattern, and perhaps Dr. Adair might be able to provide him with such a sheet of paper. His father by now had the rictus of a smile that meant his son was exposing his oddness to a stranger, and his mother was looking down into her lap. Rook folded the grid and hid it under his hand on the table. But Dr. Adair lifted his fingers from the grubby paper. "May I borrow this?" he asked. "I would like, if I may, to show it to a gentleman of my acquaintance who will be interested that it was created by a boy of 7." After Dr. Adair went, the neighbour woman brought his sisters back. She inspected Rook and said loudly, as if he were deaf or a dog, "Yes, he looks clever, don't he?" Rook felt the hairs on his head standing up with the heat of his blush. Whether it was because he was stupid or clever, it added up to the same thing, the misery of being out of step with the world.
Kate Grenville reading from her new novel, The Lieutenant, on ABC Radio National on The Book Show. So, Kate, you have made him into there's an element of a slightly Asperger's child with a talent for numbers in your young Rook.
Yes, several people have mentioned the Asperger's possibility. Look, to me, Rook is simply an extremely bright, what we would call these days gifted, child who has been unlucky enough to have not yet found any fellow souls or anybody who can understand. And so his emotional life and his social life is completely undeveloped. But I don't think of him as anything more than a very bright kid. A normal kid, in other words. He has all the potential for full emotional development, which, of course, later takes place.
Yes, I mean, he does, at a later stage, he sort of blurts his interest. He gets obsessed, doesn't he? And he doesn't notice that people around him are kind of a bit bored or... And that's why I thought, well, he's not making an emotional connection very well with these people.
No, it's a bit socially gawky. There's no question about that. But, you know... all of us who've had kids have known kids like that. I mean, several at my kids' primary school spring vividly to my memory as being completely incapable of working out what was appropriate socially, going on and on and on about some subject they were obsessed with. Nothing wrong with these kids. They were just kind of brighter than everybody else and the penny hadn't quite dropped that not everybody else was equally interested in their subject.
So in your imagination then, I mean... Presumably, you had no idea what Rook, what Rook was like because you've made him up. But yes. Dawes didn't have any inclinations like this.
Well, very little is known about the real William Dawes. I mean, we know a fair bit, but we don't know things like that. He left some letters behind, as well as the notebooks, and one or two little fragments of other sorts of official letters.
But there was no Mrs. Bartholomew there, was there?
I think there probably would have been some version of that. I kind of backtracked from what we did know, which was that he was an astronomer. Now, I don't know whether you've ever tried to come to grips with the way the planets and the solar system and the galaxies all hang around together.
I'm very impressed with people who do.
Well, so am I, because when I started to investigate these things, thinking, oh, well, he set up an observatory, he was an astronomer, I better get a bit of a handle on this, it requires... A very high level of that kind of brain, mathematical brain. So someone who's good at mathematics, I mean, we've all known a couple of those too. I certainly can think of a couple of mathematicians I've known. They have a particular sort of aura about them. And I thought, well, working backwards from what I know, that he was an astronomer, I can extrapolate and think, okay, he may in fact have the slight oddness that a lot of mathematicians have.
What about an interest in music? And that's always, that does go hand in hand with mathematics. But what about you? Are you interested in mathematics and music?
Well, I was going to quickly say no, because I can't do arithmetic to save my life. But I do love music, and the structures of music fascinate me. I don't know much about it, but, you know, I love that. And, well, researching this book, I read a lot about mathematics, not about arithmetic, but about the large theories of mathematics. And although I could only... Look, I couldn't even pretend to follow it, but I began to glimpse what it was that fascinated people. I began to see what was fascinating about it, even though I couldn't actually do it. And certainly the music and mathematics thing, and fugues. I mean, I've given Rook an obsessive interest in fugues, because fugues are a particularly pure, remote sort of music, but they are described in terms of voices. I mean, each thread of a fugue is called a voice. This is a book about conversations, so it seemed terribly appropriate that a fugue should be the particular sort of music he loved.
At one point, very early on, I think he describes language as a machine for thinking, because so he's interested in languages and how they work. Can you talk a little bit about the idea of language in this book?
Yes. You know, there's a great saying, one of your listeners can probably tell me who said it, with every language learned, man gains a soul. My mother used to quote that. She went back to university at age 50 and learned French and Italian, and she was very convinced that that was correct, and I think so too. Each language has its own take on the world. That's why our translation can never be absolutely exact. And therefore, when you enter another language and speak with its speakers, you become a slightly different person. You learn a different sort of world. And that's interesting if you're, like me, you know, Anglophone, who's learned a little bit of French. That's quite interesting. But to be someone like Daniel Rook, an 18th century soldier, who's having these conversations with a young Aboriginal girl with no dictionary to guide him, that struck me as the most extraordinary leap into the unknown, a leap of imagination by him.
Well, in fact, he's looking at the stars and he's learning things about the universe from first principles, and he's doing the same. He's actually creating his own dictionary, isn't he?
Yes, that's right.
So this relationship with this girl, When you looked at the language, the notes, are all the quotes from that you have this young girl saying and the words they discussed, that's from the journals?
Yes, one of the rules I made for myself with this book is that I would not invent any dialogue between Rook and any of the Aboriginal people. And there were plenty of conversations and plenty of words in the notebooks I didn't have to invent, and I wouldn't, and I couldn't. So that gave me at once a freedom and a boundary, which I think, writing always is improved by a bit of a boundary. So I took some of those conversations, which are simply recorded, and sometimes there's a tiny little bit of context that Dawes wrote down. And working backwards from that, I tried to invent a moment which would give rise to such a conversation, a context out of which that particular exchange of words might have happened. Now, everybody who reads those notebooks probably has a slightly different context which they invent. But it is interesting looking at the notebooks. The urge to immediately put them in a time and a place and give them a face and a body is overwhelming because they leap off the page, those notebooks. So my challenge as a fiction writer was to try to keep the raw power of what's recorded in the notebooks, but embed it in a matrix of narrative where it could shine.
Well, that brings us to the second reading I want you to do. And this is a scene between Tagaran and Rook. Do you want to just tell us what's happening and then read it?
Yes, they know each other a little bit at this point, and Rook at this point has figured out a little bit of the language. In fact, he's figured out a bit, and it's given him a rather confident feeling that he understands more than he probably really does. And he's got very fond of Tagaran. She is, in my book, somewhere between 10 and 12, he thinks, which is perhaps a tiny bit younger than the historic Pachigarang, but that suited my purposes to make her prepubescent. Tagaran ran into the hut one afternoon, goose-pimpled all over, drops of water sparkling on her skin and in her hair. Rook got up from the table, but she pushed at him with a wet hand. She said something, he thought along the lines of, "You stand between me and the fire," and got out of her way. She turned around and around in front of the flames, shivering, a purple tinge to her lips. He threw on more wood and blew at the fire until it blazed. "Boggy diu," she said, and he thought automatically, from boggy, to bathe or swim, therefore probably I bathed or have been bathing. "My dear child," he said, "it is not weather for bathing." He knew she could not have understood precisely, but saw that she caught the tone, a big brother who thought he knew best. Just as his sister Anne would, on being advised to wear her warmer but uglier shawl on a cold morning, she gave him an exasperated look. The fire was roaring in the chimney, but she was still shivering. So he took his jacket from its peg and put it around her. For an instant he felt her narrow shoulders under his hands, felt the life of her, her breathing self, right next to him. Then she twirled, like someone dancing a minuet, taking hold of the collar of the jacket as she did and handing it back to him. Straight away, he regretted that momentary touch on her shoulders. He might think of her as his sister, but Tagaran was not his sister. He wanted to explain, "I have a younger sister you remind me of." But then he thought, was that enough to justify such familiarity? If some native man had come up so close to Anne and put his hands on her shoulders, what would he feel? He stepped back. "I am sorry." It was perhaps not too late to rescue the moment. He hung the jacket on its peg, taking rather more time than the action required, and took up a position near the door, as far from her as the hut allowed. She performed another turn in front of the fire and stopped with her back to it, looking at him. He saw her thinking, her eyes going to the jacket hanging against the wall, the man standing with his arms folded at the other end of the room. "Gored you tagarin," she said, and went through a performance which included the fire and the jacket and herself shivering, from which he understood her to mean that she would become warm more quickly if she remained naked. Which was correct, he realised, and showed more understanding of the logic of wet skin and the heat of a fire than did his own world of endless garments. Her explanation told him why she had twirled herself out of what had almost been an embrace. But he saw that she was explaining something else too. She had seen his unease and understood its cause. Still, he felt awkward. In fact, he knew he was blushing. He could feel the warmth coursing through his blood, beating out against the skin. He turned to the table and made something of a to-do of getting the notebook and pen out and writing. Goredju tagarin, I moor it, that is, I take more of it, from cold. That is, to take off the cold. At this time, Tagaran was standing by the fire naked, and I wished her to put on clothes, on which she said, Goredju tagarin, the full meaning of which is, I will or do remain longer naked in order to get warm sooner, as the fire is felt better without clothes than if it had to penetrate through them. This was long-winded, but by the time he had finished, his blush had subsided and Tagaran was no longer shivering.
Kate Grenville, reading from The Lieutenant on the book show here on ABC Radio National. So, Kate, I mean, listeners can't see that a lot of the text there is in italics, and presumably yes, that's straight out of the notebooks. That's what you yes, had to deal with.
That's
and then
right,
you invented the whole the context, as you said before. Mm-hmm. But I was really interested to hear you say just before that, it suited my purposes, is what you said before, suited my yes, purposes to make the young girl younger.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I just think that's so interesting because, I mean, you know, because you've got this young soldier here in his 20s, you've got this girl, they're having these little meetings, there's lots of discussions and talks, and you are very determined to make this a sisterly relationship. You say that the big brother, you know, it was like a big brother who thought he knew best, and he reflect on his sister. In fact, very early in the book you introduce his sister, who's a very important character to him in his life. And you don't want there to be any suggestion that there's any sexual relationship here. Why?
That's right. Because what I was interested in their relationship was the friendship aspect of it. What you feel between the lines of their relationship is nothing like romantic love or sexual attraction. What you feel, reading the actual notebooks, is a relationship of huge affection, great mutual respect, but above all, playfulness. These two people, while sharing about six words, could actually have jokes and very sophisticated little ironic exchanges between each other. These were two people who simply really enjoyed each other's company and looked at each other simply as another wonderfully interesting human being. Now, that was what I was interested in the book, because to take the larger view, this shared history that we have in Australia, its best part, it seems to me, is something like this relationship, which is not, I was going to say clouded, but that's not quite the right word. It doesn't have a sexual dimension, which immediately lays another level of complication on it. This is a relationship between two people who come together because they really enjoy each other's company and minds and souls, rather than there being any suggestion of sexual exploitation. If I had made that a sexual relationship, it would have raised all sorts of questions about the imbalance of power between a white soldier and a young Aboriginal girl. It would have introduced a whole... It would have been a completely different book.
But you were on the lookout for a hero, though, weren't you? And it wouldn't have made him a hero. I mean, you were looking for a kind of relationship which was different in a way than the relationships that you wrote about in The Secret River. I mean, that's my sense of it. But why did you make her younger? Why didn't you make her 14 and still have a friendship? Do you think that was not believable?
I thought it would be, as it was, I thought that, I mean, look, how many books about a man and a woman who have a deep friendship aren't about a sexual relationship? I felt that as a writer, I had to work quite hard. I had to do everything, use all the weapons I could to say, we're looking at a different sort of relationship here, not a sexual one. So making her younger just helped that a little bit. The relationship, if she'd been 14 and him 26, then she would definitely have been, you know, a young woman rather than a child. That would have already made it
more
difficult.
She may have been a wife in Aboriginal society.
She may well have been a wife, and she may well have been a promised wife even at 10. I've given Rook a very satisfying, although sketchily sketched, sex life, so that because I also didn't want it
and
to
seem
like...
And you've made him very well endowed, Kate, too. In fact,
why not?
All of the chaps in your book are extremely well endowed. Have you noticed that?
I haven't. I'm interested that you've been through and
I have. I've underlined them. I thought, I wonder whether I should raise this, but now I have.
Good thing this is radio. Where do you think that comes from? I'm blushing. Well, in this book, I wanted him to be well endowed. Well, partly because it gave me a nice line of kind of slightly funny line for the woman to remark on his endowment, but also for there to be no doubt that there were no problems with his sexuality. He's got a perfectly robust sexual identity, which doesn't need to be displaced or sublimated or any of those sorts of words onto a relationship with a young girl. The thing that I most dreaded is that this book might be read as a sublimated pedophilia sort of relationship. That would have undone everything I was trying to do.
You've got this character called Silk, who is, I suppose, loosely based on Watkin Tench. Is that right?
Yes, that's right.
Why do you call him Silk?
When I decided to change all the names, I looked up... Isn't Google wonderful? You can look up the Portsmouth Parish records for the 1760s, when these blokes would have been born, and it gives you a list of names. And I went through them and in a very random, intuitive sort of way, thought, what will I call my characters? Now, Tench, Watkin Tench, is a very suave, sophisticated, very attractive man. So when one of the names in this list was Silk, I thought, perfect.
Yeah, very silky.
And he is very silky, yes.
He's smooth.
Yes, and there's nothing wrong with that.
Oh, no, I'm not criticising him. Don't you get defensive with me, Kate Grenville. I'm not criticising your character. No.
Good.
But look, he's a writer, isn't he? And he's sort
of—he's
a much more—he's a more suggestive kind of chap. He's very sophisticated. He's got a kind of worldly, sort of metropolitan view, hasn't he, about what's going on?
Indeed, he does. As did the real Watkin Tench. In fact, I've quoted a little bit from Tench's actual narrative of Botany Bay that he published in 1790, whenever it was, because the language is so attractive. He's an incredibly attractive man. I mean, text publishing was brilliant a few years ago when they retrieved that book out of the archives, where only historians ever looked at it, and republished it. It's now become a bestseller, 1788. Such an attractive, amiable sort of voice comes through it.
But he is, he's got a different kind of view to Rook about what's going on around him.
He does, yes. I have a scene where... Rook has written down all these notes, including this one about, you know, standing by the fire naked. And Silk, who's a good friend, happens to come across it. Now, Silk, with his much more cosmopolitan and perhaps slightly cynical view of the world, immediately reads it sexually. Mm. And I wrote that scene, well, partly because it gave me a moment of great drama between the two men, because it's also a book about the friendship between the two of them. But it also gave me another chance to demonstrate what was going on in Rook's head, which is he, for a while, didn't quite understand what Silk was getting at. He is so innocent that he doesn't even realise that the things he's written down in the book could possibly have a sexual interpretation.
So they could have had a sexual interpretation.
Well, when you read them in the book, some of them, as that
in
one,
the journal,
about, in the journal, sorry,
yeah.
Some of them do leap off the page in our prurient 21st century eyes.
Because she's
very
naked
easy.
And he says, you
that's
know, put
right.
your coat on. And
put your
she says,
on,
no,
right. yes.
I don't want to. It's better like this.
That's right.
And
there
and
are
you've
other
decided
things.
That's not sexual.
Well, that's right, yes. Because we know very little about Pachigurang and not that much about Dawes, people who know more about this, you know, historically than I do, are slightly divided on it. But most people think that she probably was fairly young, and in fact, that the relationship probably wasn't sexual. I mean, the other thing about it is that in 1788, there was no shortage of available women for the officers. When you read the documents...
There was a lot of damned whores and everything.
Well, they weren't all damned whores. A lot of them were quite nice women,
and
I think.
And God's police, of course.
And God's police, of course. But all the officers had mistresses, or many of them. So, you know, there was no shortage of available women.
So the other thing that's really interesting is this idea of a language and the fun of learning languages and what a particular language might tell you about what the world view and in fact the soul of the people who are talking and speaking it. Language as supple as Sophocles or Homer. Tell me about that.
Well, when I was doing the research, I mean, I don't know anything about languages really, but someone mentioned to me, a person who does know, that Dawes thought, he's actually written down in his notebooks, that the language was inflected and that it used, and I may not have the right term, the dual plural. In other words, they didn't just say, I mean, inflected, first of all, like Latin, so that you've got all the, in the one word, you've got all the things that the verb might be. But the dual plural is something we don't have in English, though I think we used to back in Old English. It means that when you say we, you may mean just yourself and the person standing next to you, or by using another word, you can say myself and everybody on this side of the fence sort of thing. In other words, you can be very discriminating in just exactly which groups of people you mean by we. It's a very, very closely calibrated little pronoun, which we don't have. And apparently, I've been told, and I don't know if this is true, ancient Greek has the same incredibly sophisticated thing. Now, as an educated man of the late 18th century, Rook would, I think, certainly have known ancient Greek and Latin very well. So it gave me a chance to reveal his kind of innocent excitement and also to say what, in fact, linguists, I believe, do feel about many Aboriginal languages is that they are extraordinarily sophisticated grammatically.
Mm. We've had this conversation before about your decision that you can't portray an Aboriginal character unless, well, in this case, you had the actual words that were said, but you actually have portrayed something beyond the actual words, haven't you? Does that mean you've shifted a little bit?
No, but having the conversations gave me a huge window into those moments. With The Secret River, I did make the decision in the end not to attempt dialogue between white and black, mostly because I tried and failed. And as a writer, I think you have to admit when it's not working. With this book, I had the conversations, and because the book is all through the eyes of Daniel Rook, certainly he makes interpretations about the Aboriginal people, which may or may not be correct. It's his view. It's not mine. I'm not saying that they think whatever. It's Rook. This is very much a book about one man and his interior development, his transformation from that gawky, emotionally stunted little boy to a man of absolutely full, robust, rich emotionality and sense of morality, his sense of his place in the human society.
Although he retains that sense of an outsider, doesn't he, that he had as a boy?
It gives him the courage to act as many more conventional people wouldn't act. So that outsiderdom, it stands him in good stead in many ways. First of all, it makes him quite a good listener, as he perceives at one point. And when you're learning a language from first principles, the ability to actually listen and absorb and open yourself to that experience is vital. And because he's a good listener and not all that great with people, he recognises that this is actually quite a good qualification for doing what he's trying to do.
Were you a bit in love with him?
It's interesting you should say that, because since the book has been out, various other people have told me that, quite a few people besides me are or have been interested in William Dawes, and a lot of them use that phrase, you know, being in love with Dawes. No, I mean, I've pictured him as, I think, a very... he'd be quite hard to deal with, I think, socially. Hard going. bit laborious. On the other hand, I really admire him and respect him for the sort of person he is.
He doesn't do much wrong, though. He doesn't set a foot wrong, does he?
Well, he doesn't have much chance. He certainly sets plenty of feet wrong socially. What do you mean, sort of morally, or
no? I just mean he's sort of he's a hero. He's a real hero.
Well, this is a novel. Yes,
We don't get too many of those these days. We get anti-heroes again and again and again.
A novel with a proper, lovable hero with something resembling a happy ending. It is unusual,
right,
isn't it?
I know. What are you doing? What are you doing to us?
Well, I'm glad you feel like that about Rook, because I wanted him to be thoroughly likeable, and Tagaran too, to be thoroughly likeable. People that you want to live with for the time it takes you to read a book.
And, but that does, you know, that just that does get me to sort of ask, you know, that they, you know, you've invented them for a purpose. You wanted this to be a perfect relationship, or a mighty fine one, in contrast to the kinds of relationships you've written about before.
Well, I wanted it to be an exploratory relationship. I don't really think it's perfect. I mean, Rook does make mistakes with his relationship. I mean, for example, the scene I just read where he comes up a bit too close and touches her. That's a mistake. So what we're watching is somebody fumbling towards his understanding of actually what is right, and he very nearly blows it several times. And in fact, it's sometimes she who retrieves it from possible disaster and misunderstanding. So I think it's more that it's not so much that I'm showing a kind of perfect relationship as that I'm showing two people with extreme goodwill, and in both cases very clever and subtle people, building together towards knowing each other and relating to each other. Well, that seemed to me not a bad project to undertake.
Not a bad project indeed. And the book we've been speaking about is The Lieutenant, and it's published by Text. And Kate Granville, it's always a pleasure to speak with you.
Lovely, Ramona.
Next on the book show, Mahmoud Darwish is considered the Palestinian national poet. He was also a journalist and involved in the peace process with Israel. He wrote poems of exile and resistance, but also of love. And when he died at the age of 67 after heart surgery recently, he was mourned across the Arab world and also in Europe. So Arabic poetry on the book show later on today after 10 a.m. Remember, you can hear this program again just by going to the website abc.net.au/rn/bookshow. You can download us as a podcast. You can find today's guest and book details there too. You can send us a note. That's all from me, Ramona Koval, on ABC Radio National. Time now for the news.
G'day, Paul Barclay here from Australia Talks. Australia's always been good at digging it up and shipping it out, and it's underwriting our current prosperity. But how innovative are we? Should we invest more in R&D? We'll examine calls for a major boost to government funding for research, including big tax concessions. Listen now or download as an MP3 podcast from the Radio National website. Just go to abc.net.au/rn and follow the prompts to Australia Talks.